The Northwestern Medicine Functional Bowel Disease Program addresses disabling and painful bowel disorders, which really can affect up to 20% of the adult population. My guests in this panel discussion today are Dr. Darren Brenner. He's an associate professor of medicine and surgery, and Dr. Jennifer Kai. She's an assistant professor of medicine, and they're both with Northwestern Medicine. Thank you so much, doctors, for joining us. Dr. Brenner, I'd like to start with you and kind of set the stage. What are considered functional bowel disorders?
Hi, thanks, Melanie. So functional bowel disorders runs a gamut of different illnesses that span the GI tract from the esophagus all the way down to the anal sphincters. These are predominantly defined as disorders whereby we don't have good definitive diagnostic studies, radiologic studies, serologic studies, biochemical studies to make a concrete diagnosis. So for example, if someone walks in the door with hypertension, you can check their blood pressure and you'll see that it's high. But some of the functional bowel disorder like irritable bowel syndrome, we don't have a test that definitively makes an accurate diagnosis. So a lot of times this is based on subjective analysis of a patient's symptoms.
So tell us a little bit about the Northwestern Medicine Functional Bowel Disease Program. It's the first of its kind that patients have access to this entire multidisciplinary team of specialists. Dr. Brenner, how does that differentiate Northwestern Medicine? What's so special about that?
Well, I think it's the fact that it's a more integrated and collaborative program. Within the Northwestern Integrated Bowel Dysfunction Program, we incorporate not only gastroenterologists, but colorectal surgeons, lifestyle medicine specialists, psychologists, and dietitians in order to give or to take a more biopsychosocial approach to the patient's symptoms or issues. We know a lot of times with functional GI disorders that diet can play a major role in the symptom profile, and we're now looking at modifying that, modifying the gut microbiome. But we also know that social or psychiatric issues like anxiety, depression, and stress can worsen symptoms as well. So historically, people have looked at these types of disorders and just tried to treat the biological mechanisms behind them. But that's only one piece of the puzzle. And a more global or unified treatment protocol or even diagnostic protocol can be more beneficial in terms of patient outcomes.
Well, it certainly does. Dr. Brenner, I'm sticking with you for a second. So tell us how that access benefits the patient and what impact does it have for general providers, PCPs? How is that? I mean, it's such a multidisciplinary approach, as you described, and so comprehensive. Tell us how that works for the patient and for the PCPs.
Sure, Melanie. So from the PCP's perspective, a lot of times I say I'm lucky because I get to practice in an ivory tower. A lot of times they'll come to conferences and lectures and say, hey, I've got the traditional medications or holistic therapies that I can give them over the counter, but I don't have access to the dietitians or the behavioral psychologists in order to provide some of the other services that you and other major academic institutions have proven beneficial. So we're happy to offer that service. One benefit from the patient standpoint, I think, is not only from a treatment protocol, but from a time perspective. You know, we think that patients' time is of the utmost importance. And in many instances, if you need to see a dietitian or a behavioral psychologist or a gastroenterologist or a colorectal surgeon, you have to make 3 to 4 visits. And especially myself living on the North Shore, the Northwest suburbs of Chicago, I know that can be very time consuming. So we have one specific program, which again is known as the Northwestern Integrative Bowel Dysfunction Program. And this program meets once a month. It's usually for people with severe refractory pelvic floor syndromes like constipation or fecal incontinence. And within a single visit, the patient will see myself, Dr. Halverson, our colorectal surgeon if need be, Vana, our pelvic floor physical therapist, Beth Dorfler, our dietitian, and Dr. Sarah Quinton, who heads our behavioral psychology program. So it's literally like getting 5 consults at one. But the nice thing is we're all in the room at the same time, so we're all hearing the same history, asking the same questions, bouncing diagnostic and therapeutic protocols off each other, and also off the patient at the same time. So we think that this has a more beneficial overall response, and it's something we're actually looking at in clinical trials currently.
Wow, I would certainly imagine for the patient to have all of you experts sitting there at once, it really must be an amazing experience. So, Dr. Kai, Dr. Brenner was speaking about physiological and psychological. He was talking about behavioral therapists. And before we talk about pelvic floor, because he mentioned that as well, why is it so important? Besides treating the physiological issue, whatever the problem is, but the psychological aspects of these disorders, where does that come into play?
You know, Melanie, that's a great question. I think one example that we can look at is IBS. It can be very helpful to address not just the GI symptoms associated with IBS, whether they be diarrhea or constipation, but also to address the pain symptoms that these patients have. And oftentimes it's related to their disease, to the hypersensitivity and the overdrive of the autonomic nervous system. And so using behavioral health therapists and there are different techniques such as cognitive behavioral therapy or gut-directed hypnotherapy in concert with pharmacologic therapy, it can provide an additional benefit to these patients.
Melanie, I agree with everything that Dr. Kai said. You know, a lot of people, when we talk to them about behavioral therapies, including the cognitive behavioral therapy and hypnotherapy, they think this is a lot of voodoo or mumbo jumbo that we're just bringing up. Because remember, a lot of these patients have been told that a lot of their symptoms are all in their head. So when you've predisposed them to that thought process and you start talking about psychological interventions, they can sometimes lose faith in not only the diagnosis you're giving, but the treatment protocols. It's very important for our audience to know that there have been numerous randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials that have shown that behavioral therapy and hypnotherapy can be very effective. Now, the placebo in these trials are usually education groups, but there is some benefit to that as well. In fact, Northwestern was one of the two institutions that spearheaded the largest NIH trial to date, looking at the effects of cognitive behavioral therapy for treating IBS symptoms, showing that it's very, very effective, and that people can get very good responses in a short period of time, only 4 sessions. More recently, we've shown that if patients respond, there's no decay out to at least a year. So if they have those 4 sessions and they're doing better, the vast majority still feel good at the end of a year without any further interventions. And we know around that brain-gut interplay that newer technologies are coming to pass to improve the symptoms that Dr. Kai talked about, specifically pain. And there is now a wealth of literature, at least initial trials, showing that people can use virtual reality to treat pain and everything from functional bowel diseases to cancer. And soon we hope to be enrolling patients at Northwestern into a virtual reality study for irritable bowel syndrome as well.
That really is fascinating. Doctors, both of you, because I read that NIH study, and so many women and men suffer from these types of disorders, and they are told that it's all in their head. And so working that way is so beneficial. Now, Dr. Kai, another area that Dr. Brenner mentioned is nutrition. And of course, diet plays such a role in our gut health. Tell us about the importance of having a nutritionist be part of an IBS patient treatment plan.
So having a registered dietitian or a nutritionist engage in the treatment plan of IBS is really critical. I think one example of this is in the administration of a low FODMAP diet. And FODMAPs are essentially carbohydrates, which are difficult to digest. They go into the colon where bacteria causes fermentation. And then that creates gases, which can result in the patients feeling their symptoms of abdominal pain and bloating. And so patients often will come into clinic complaining or feeling like they have, quote unquote, failed after trying to manage this really complicated diet by themselves, either with the aid of a few handouts or their own online research. But the benefit of having a dietitian who's trained in GI disorders is that they're able to help these patients really personalize their dietary therapy to maximize the chance that it will work. And so one example is that we often focus on the elimination portion of these diets, because that's when we get rid of the foods that are potentially causing the problem. But we know that patients shouldn't stay on this type of restricted diet forever. And so what's equally, if not more important, is the reintroduction phase, where these foods are gradually re-added to the diet to see if they can be tolerated or if they reproduce symptoms. And it's in this process that takes time, it takes effort, and it's when the expertise of a dietitian is really crucial to the success of not only the treatment plan, but also of that patient's ability to maintain that diet for the future.
Melanie, I agree. You know, one of the other benefits of having a registered dietitian is that they really focus on this subset of practice. As Dr. Kai mentioned, we talk about the low FODMAP diet being beneficial for irritable bowel syndrome, but one of the concerns we have is where patients get their information regarding these diets. And I can tell you that the internet is not a panacea. Recently, there was a study published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology that looked at recommendations for low FODMAP diets, and we found even at the academic level at three major centers of excellence that the recommendations for low FODMAP diets were more discordant than concordant, meaning that the three academic centers agreed less on what constituted a low FODMAP diet than they agreed. So you really want to have someone in place at your institution that knows a lot about this, that's probably doing some clinical research with this, to give the patients the likelihood of the best outcomes.
What a good point that you both made. So, Dr. Brenner, tell us about some of the clinical trials you and your colleagues at Northwestern Medicine are involved in, any recent discoveries or findings you can share. And while you're doing that, please give us a brief synopsis of your talk on anorectal disorders at the upcoming ANMS annual meeting.
So we've been involved in a lot of clinical trials here recently at Northwestern. You know, we previously talked about the cognitive behavioral trial, and forthcoming will be the trial using virtual reality to treat irritable bowel syndrome. We have also worked on trials of specific pharmaceuticals. There is a medication called placanotide, which we trialed for people with irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, and were able to show that this improves global IBS with constipation symptoms, but also subsyndromic symptoms, including bloating, distension, sensations of incomplete evacuation, and improving quality of life. Most recently, we completed a study with a medication called alexatiline, which is FDA approved for the treatment of irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, specifically looking at patients who had failed an over-the-counter antidiarrheal therapy called loperamide. Now, this is important because a lot of people, and specifically patients, want to use over-the-counter agents first. And historically, we always compare the medications that we do in these trials to placebo. But sometimes we need better real-world analyses of what's going to happen to these individuals when they take these drugs in a real-world setting. And so what we did is we took people who had tried the over-the-counter, failed that, used this new therapeutic called alexatiline, and found that it was effective for these patients as well. Moving forward, we're looking again at quality of life outcomes with respect to patients who are seen in our integrated bowel dysfunction program. We're also going to be using a drug that is FDA approved for treating chronic constipation and irritable bowel syndrome with constipation to try and treat constipation in individuals with cystic fibrosis, as there are currently no drugs that are FDA approved for this indication. We're also working with a couple of other pharmaceutical companies on drugs for a disorder called gastroparesis.
Dr. Kai, first last word to you. Tell us what you would like other providers to know about the Northwestern Medicine Functional Bowel Disease Program and when you feel it's important that they refer.
So great question. I think functional GI disorders are very common, and primary care physicians are often the first line who see these patients. But there are some alarm features that, if present, should prompt a referral to GI, including bleeding or weight loss, evidence of iron deficiency anemia, or if they have a family history of an organic disease like cancer or inflammatory bowel disease. And so these symptoms could indicate that there's another etiology that we should be ruling out, either with endoscopy or colonoscopy or additional imaging, before we label it as a functional disease. And I'll just add that there are also a number of conditions that primary care physicians and other specialists often see that have a significant functional GI component. A few that come to mind include Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and scleroderma, where 90% of scleroderma patients actually have some degree of GI involvement. And half of them are actually symptomatic with some of the conditions that we've talked about today. And so even though these patients have another underlying disorder, they can still really benefit from seeing GI motility specialist for their GI symptoms and sequelae.
Yeah, Jennifer, I agree. I think we're here to kind of cover the gamut of what we can do for our colleagues who also practice general medicine and gastrointestinal medicine and all the other subspecialties as well, but also for our patients. And I like to look at it as kind of a place they can come for any types of interventions that they need. Sometimes patients are just referred to us because their doctors want to confirm the diagnosis, and that's fine. Other times they're referred for diagnostic testing. We're honored and able to offer esophageal testing from manometry to pH impedance to FLIP to motility testing, including smart pill, breath testing for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and carbohydrate malabsorption, and then anorectal testing for constipation and fecal incontinence. So we're happy to do that testing and then take over the patient's care if our colleagues would like, or to just do the testing again because they don't have that available to them. For finally, again, we pride ourselves on that multidisciplinary biopsychosocial approach. We do feel it's probably the best way to treat a patient overall.
Great information, and what a fantastic multidisciplinary comprehensive program. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise. That wraps up this episode of Better Edge, a Northwestern Medicine podcast for physicians. For more information on the latest advances in medicine, please check out nm.org to get connected with one of our providers. If you as a provider found this podcast as informative as I did, please share with other providers so they know when to refer. Share with your friends and family on social media, because this is really important information that we can all learn together from the experts. And don't miss all the other fascinating podcasts in our library. Until next time, I'm Melanie Cole.